Support is provided by Otter Tail Power Company, providing safe, reliable, and affordable electricity for more than 100 years, while balancing community, economic, and environmental commitments, always.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street all across North Dakota. UND Professor Diana D'Amico-Polowitz is a scholar of the history of education reform and public policy, and she says the way we educate our children is a window into American society. Polowitz is the author of Blaming Teachers, Professionalization Policies, and the Failure of Reform in American History, and she recently sat down with Prairie Pulse host John Harris to talk about it.
Tell us about the book and why you wrote it.
Yeah, well, so why did I write this book? You know, I've been working on this project for some time, and I think there are a couple things that came together. You know, the first is that as a historian, from early on, I had this understanding that public education is not just about classrooms. These aren't just kind of these sealed off institutions, but public schools are like windows onto American society. So if we want to learn about political debates or social anxieties or the aspirations of the nation, you know, public schools are an amazing place to look. And that's certainly playing out now today. And then at the time the project was starting, we were kind of right in the midst of this NCLB moment. And what I was hearing just a ton of was, it's those darn teachers, right? A lot of blaming teachers, a lot of trying to reform teachers. And so it was kind of what was going on at that moment sent me back to, you know, how did we get to where we are right now? So that's really what the book was about.
Yeah. So why is it so easy to blame the teachers?
Right.
And, you know, and why is it that professional is sort of politicized?
Yeah, it's a good question, you know, and I think there's a couple of reasons why it's so easy to blame teachers today. You know, I think the first reason is because we've always been doing it. It's become kind of like the grammar of public schooling, right? You know, we have, why do we sit kids in rows and desks? Why do we organize them by grades? Why do we blame teachers? That's what public school has been about, right? I think another reason why we blame teachers is because, you know, in some ways, they're easy targets. They become the consummate straw man, and it's much easier to blame teachers than it is to say, gosh, we have to reform the entire system or think about social inequality or something like that. You know, and the reason why we originally started blaming teachers goes back to a story from really the mid-19th century with the rise of public schools, where there was not a lot of faith in public school teachers, and particularly the women that were recruited to schools. And so embedded in this blame that we see was a lot of gender discourse about why women weren't up to the task, why they weren't doing well enough. And so that really has set the table for this policy story that has shaped public schooling.
Yeah, but can you talk about I guess, the New York City school system in particular, which you do write about, and the struggles teachers have there and faced over the years?
Yeah. So the book is sort of about New York City's in some ways. That's kind of how we enter into the story. And in a lot of ways, you know, New York City is this kind of exceptional story. There's not a lot of cities like it. It's huge there. But in the other ways, though, it is this kind of evocative case in that it's been a theater for all kinds of policy debates, that we have the way unions sort of started there and spread out across the country, the debates in teacher education. So one of the things I write about in the book is how big cities like New York City have become this kind of harbinger for education policy that we see across. But one of the things I see in the book is that, you know, from very early on, there's a lot of faith in the ability of public schools to fix social problems. And then when those schools kind of fall short, right, when they're not doing the things that we hoped they would do, there's a whole lot of hand-wringing there. And attention turns pretty quickly to teachers, right, and policymakers. And this goes back to, you know, mid-1800s and plays out in the present still. We'll say, gosh, you know, if only we had better teachers, well, then we'd have better schools, right? And so what teachers have been trapped in is this cycle of reform that has kind of put one policy over another in an attempt to kind of make them better in some way. But the key is that those policies, what they have ended up doing is really just creating this bureaucratic system of schooling where it was really focused on standardization and measurement and efficiency. And so even though we constantly talk about this idea of teacher professionalization, what teachers, I think a lot of them would tell us is that, you know, my authority has been taken away, my autonomy has taken away, and gosh, I don't feel like I have a whole lot of respect. And those are the critical markers of profession. So it really is this story about how we talk about profession in name, but the things that we've done to teachers have really kind of cut them off at the knees.
Yeah. Well, you talked about unions right there at the moment, but you write about the pros and cons of teachers' unions. Can you expand on that?
Sure. Yeah, you know, I think the first thing to understand is that the unions that we have are a reflection of the public schools that we have, right? If our public schools were organized in a different kind of way, then we would not have teacher representation the way we do. But the reason we have it the way this is because there really is no other opportunity for teachers to have their voices heard. And I think that, you know, there's been this kind of complex history of the role of teacher unions. Sometimes they've clashed heads with communities. But I think what we're seeing right now is a new page in the history of teacher unionization, where there's a lot of collaboration with communities. There's a lot of advocacy, not just for what's best for teachers' material interests, but what's best for schools, what's best for communities. So we've seen when teachers are going on strike, it's not really just for these bread and butter issues, but it's also for more school support services and really standing in defense of public education. And I think one of the things that we're seeing lately is that unions have played a really important role, even in this COVID moment, right, is that so many parents and policymakers and politicians are anxious to just open up schools, right, get kids back in so that we can have whatever normal feels like. The union has been a really key player in saying, we want that too, but we also need safe schools, right? And I think teachers have a lot of reason to feel somewhat cautious because, as any of them could tell us, there have been many times they've gone into school and haven't had hand sanitizer or haven't had bathroom, you know, soap in the bathrooms or things like that. And so now, I think, you know, they need some more than kind of a general promise that there will be masks and things. There needs to be some kind of evidence of that because it is a huge risk, not just for them, but for all the families that send their kids back. And the union has been a key role in pressing for that, even as it's been unpopular.
Yeah. Now you mentioned COVID, and let's talk about that just a minute. I guess now, especially during the COVID for the last quite a few months, we've seen how schools are sometimes sort of child care centers for parents. Can you talk about the immense challenges COVID has put on the education system?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, I think one of the things that's been most interesting about this pandemic is that it really has illuminated for so many of us all the things that public education does for a community, right? I think a lot of people might have been flippant, you know, gosh, a teacher's work is so simple and they're just, you know, just work from 9 to 3 and, you know, and it's just about teaching kids and how hard could that be? And I think what they're realizing now is that not only is the task of working with children enormously complex, but it's not even just about that, right? Schools are about so much more. They're about warm meals for kids in need. They're about safe spaces for kids who might not have one, and also critical services for kids who have disabilities. And so I think that really has brought a lot of attention or been eye-opening for folks, and that parents struggling at home are realizing that, you know, the work of schooling is just hard business.
Well, and of course, even the social interaction that we all need. But what about, you know, a lot of parents have struggled during COVID, you know, whether it's because, you know, they've had work or really weren't equipped to effectively monitor an at-home school learning with their child. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, being a full-time working parent, being home with kids and trying to monitor their learning is a huge challenge for me personally with my 4 kids, but for any parent, you know. And I think also part of the complexity, though, is that, you know, schools were really struggling to figure out how to do this. They didn't have a whole lot of time. They certainly didn't have a whole lot of resources. You know, we didn't really see this pandemic coming. So the first time and back in the last spring when we shut down schools, there was no time for teachers to really think about what does meaningful online learning look like. It was just this kind of scramble. And I think even that's been the same. You know, I think we spent a lot of time this summer not telling teachers where we were, what we were going to do. And there were no additional additional resources given to say, you know, folks, let's talk about what high quality online instruction looks like and how we create that. I think what a lot of kids are experiencing is this kind of, you know, teachers are just putting things together as best as they possibly can. And it's complicated. You know, in our own home, internet was out this morning. Yeah. So
what do you do then?
What do you do? Yeah.
Let's stick with online learning for a moment. It seems to have failed for many children,
yeah,
or at least been a struggle for many. Yeah. I say it that way. Can you comment on that? Why is it that? I mean, yeah, why is that been that way for so many?
It's a good question, and I don't have a set answer for that. What I would say, though, is that I think that while some kids have struggled, some kids have realized this has actually been great for them. I think also it's hard to judge the efficacy of online learning by what we see happening right now, because of what I was just talking about a moment ago, is that this has been put together, right, so quickly that teachers really didn't have time to learn all these different platforms, to think about how they might use them. And so, you know, I think that's hard. But I also think something that you mentioned earlier is absolutely right, is that there's a huge social component in learning that's really hard to duplicate that. I mean, I feel that in my own classes when I teach adults that, you know, we have amazing conversations online, and I'm so grateful for the hard work my students do, but it's just not the same as sitting face-to-face and having those conversations.
With that, I mean, do you foresee, I hope you've got a better crystal ball than me,
right,
that schools will be open for all in-person starting fall 2021, even though a few are definitely going in-person now?
I sure hope so. You know, and I think it'll rest on a few things. How well we do with the vaccine, can we delay gratification in other ways, right? I think that if we're willing to not do some other things, that schools might be a perfectly safe space, right? And I think in terms of the university, they've been doing a great job. They're talking about vaccinating faculty. They've been doing a ton of testing. And there are already lots of classes that are face-to-face. And so that's been working pretty well at the university.
What is your best advice, I guess, for students, mm-hmm, who are thinking of going into the teaching profession?
Yeah. Well, go to a college of education like the University of North Dakota. Don't try and run around that. I think that there are pathways that people can get into the classroom without getting a professional preparation, and that's problematic. I think it doesn't arm them with the kind of, you know, professional knowledge and experience that they really need. I think learn about the communities and the kids that you're going to work with, and from the start, really realize that what you're doing is not just limited to your classroom, but that your classroom is shaped by the communities that kids are coming from, whether or not they've had a warm breakfast, do they have a safe place to play, and all of these things. And so to think about what you're doing, not just about this homework assignment, but the bigness of how you're engaging a kid in their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's get back to your book for a moment. You write about the ways in which female and male teachers get along or are treated in the education system. Can you touch on this?
Yeah, you know, gender is a really important part of understanding the teaching profession. We can't talk about teachers as if it's a genderless profession. The fact of the matter is today and historically, it's been a field dominated by women, and that's been by design. But that kind of composition has also meant that teachers have been limited in a lot of ways. So one of the examples that you can see that at play is that we have teachers, women, but then they're managed by largely male populations, right? And when we think about policymakers and reformers, so it's a lot of these dynamics of men talking about how women ought to do their work better. And so that is a historical phenomenon that has played out.
Yeah. So why was teaching such a female-dominated profession in the 19th and 20th century, and how much is it still that way today, or how much has it changed?
Yeah. Well, you know, so one of the stories I write about in my book, and I tell people when I talk about this history, is that, you know, in the mid-19th century, public schooling was not a new idea. It was actually a really unpopular idea. Folks were not interested in it. The idea of public education felt like, you know, governmental overreach, public waste of money, and things like that. By the 1850s, though, something changes, and that's immigration. We've got huge numbers of immigrants coming along the Northeast in the United States. And all of a sudden, there becomes a lot of anxiety about what's happening or not happening in the home, right? And so from very early on, this public schools become a way to sort of fit in for what's not happening in these deficient homes, these homes that were perceived as deficient, and that teachers were perceived as these kind of stand-in mothers who could bring these kind of values that they maybe weren't getting. So very early on, that's what brought women to the field. In addition to that, there was a sense that we have these systems. We need a lot of folks. We need folks who are rule followers, right? And we need folks who aren't going to cost us a lot of money. And at that time, everybody was like, it's the ladies.
Well, so how do you think the public views teachers as a whole today?
Yeah. You know, I think that teachers live on a two-sided coin that kind of flips at the drop of a hat. And on one side of that coin is this idea of teacher as savior, right? We are celebrating them as self-sacrificing public servants. You know, when you think about last March, the kind of parades that we were having in communities of kids and parents waving to teachers as they're driving through, and all the parents saying, gosh, I'm so grateful for the teachers. I didn't realize all you did. But that flips pretty quickly. And on the other side of that coin is this story of teacher blame, right? Where teacher is the problem. And we're blaming teachers for being greedy or self-interested if they're not doing what we want them to do. And that's very much where we are right now, right? In a lot of communities, we're blaming teachers and unions for the fact that schools aren't opening, when teachers really are just saying, hey, we want schools to open just safely.
Sure.
Right? Yeah.
So, you know, teacher salaries. Always been talked about, I think, as long as I've been living. Yeah. So why is that such a debate? And why are teacher salaries seem to be low?
Yeah. Well, it traces back to this gendered history, right? Initially, there was the argument that we're paying teachers, we're paying women what they're worth. And early on, the idea was that women workers are not worth as much as male counterparts. Right? And I think that because of this kind of bureaucratic nature of schooling, we need a lot of teachers, that there are arguments that even though in districts, the largest expenditures go to teacher salaries, it's still not very much, as you just said, right? Teachers are earning much less than they would in other professions, which is an endemic problem that schools are going to have to face and are facing when it comes to recruiting.
Well, as people might get a chance to read your book, does it relate as New York City as it would in Grand Forks, North Dakota?
Yeah, you know, I think the book really tells a story about what's happening in the United States, right? So it's focused on New York City, but there are examples from across. And I think that what we see happening, there are key differences in communities, right? There are almost 14,000 school districts in the United States, and they are each local, right, and based on these distinctive features. But there's also a lot of these similar attributes, and that's what the book talks about. And so, yeah, I've been surprised moving to Grand Forks after growing up in New York City about how much actually is the same. It's not as different as I might have thought it would have been.
And what's been the reaction so far to the book?
It's been very positive. Yeah, it's been very positive and well received by other historians and academics, and it's got a great reception, popular audiences. I was able to do a launch of the book with Randy Weingarten, who's the president of the AFT.
Well, with that said, where can people get more information or find a copy of your book? I'll just say Blaming Teachers.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, you know, it's widely available online. So you can get it through the publisher at Rutgers University Press, Amazon.com, Bookshop, if you want to support local booksellers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us
thank
today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
UND Education Professor Diana D'Amico-Polowitz in a conversation with John Harris. This evening's Prairie Pulse television show will feature Dennis Beck in a conversation about the Veteran Liaison Officer Wall of Honor. It airs at 8 Central. Next on Main Street, Harvest Public Media reports about rural broadband access.
Next time on The Pulse,
STIR6=.
Researchers are finding out more about how kids learn.
What happens in the brain when we learn is there's change in the brain. Your brain creates new connections.
But how much of these findings are actually making it into schools?
Teaching reading is rocket science.
The role of research in education.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Donald Trump won 2/3 of the vote in rural areas in 2 presidential elections. Those numbers underline what some see as a growing divide between rural and urban parts of America. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports that one suggestion to bridge that divide is to increase high-speed internet access.
Sarah McKee lives on a county highway in rural Missouri. The closest town is St. James, with a population of 4,000. She's a nurse practitioner working on a graduate degree. During the pandemic, reporters have relied on Zoom to do interviews. McKee couldn't talk to me that way.
Yeah, with my current internet provider, there's no way that we could Zoom. I had some classes as well that were done via video chat, and it would often cut out, freeze. I've had it happen in an exam.
McKee says she had to drive into town and find a free Wi-Fi hotspot to finish that exam as part of her nurse midwifery degree. Her husband is also working on a graduate degree, and her two kids are doing remote learning during the pandemic. She says the situation is untenable.
It's so slow that when I ask some IT friends, it's actually measuring slower than dial-up connection would be.
McKee says she and her husband have considered moving over the matter. That's exactly the kind of person the Washington, D.C.-based Brookings Institution was thinking about when they published a policy paper on how the Biden administration can unify the country and appeal to rural voters. Tony Pippo is the lead author on the report. He says too many people think that the way to take care of rural areas is with huge agricultural subsidies. Pippo says that sector makes up only 6% of employment in rural areas.
Much more of service economy is becoming important in rural areas. Much more small business and entrepreneurialism. And you just can't be connected to the way the economy works right now if you don't have literally the bandwidth to be connected.
Pippa is recommending the Biden administration make a huge investment in expanding rural broadband access, backing up the infrastructure with personnel to make it work, and using that as a flashpoint for real economic development. Casey Canfield is a professor at Missouri University of Science and Technology who studies rural broadband access. She says the Brookings report has some merit, specifically the part of the proposal that suggests rural broadband expansion focuses on homes. Canfield says that would support the growth areas of remote working and self-employment.
That type of employment really benefits from having broadband access. And if we think about providing broadband access to homes, that might really help facilitate that type of job creation.
But is better internet access enough to change the hearts and minds of rural voters who backed Trump for two elections? Crystal Golnick thinks it can, at least for some conservatives. She runs a communications business from her home about an hour outside of Kansas City, where the internet access is very poor. She also works with some rural areas on programs to improve broadband access. Golnick says if improved broadband leads to more jobs and a better quality of life, it will open some eyes.
And that's coming from someone who's not, you know, political one way or the other. So I'm looking at the interconnectedness and what it really means to people. It's less about personalities in office than it is in making sure that we have the resources we need as a country.
Tony Pippa of the Brookings Institution says 4 years isn't a lot of time to make significant and noticeable changes in rural access to the internet. But he says if the Biden administration moves quickly, funds programs well, and cuts the bureaucracy to implement them, it will send a strong message.
I think that will matter. Will it bring everybody on board, you know, politically speaking, 4 years from now? I'm not sure, but I think you have a much better shot at it than if we remain with the status quo or just try to tweak around the edges with what's actually in place right now.
Rural broadband is already on the Biden administration's radar. Expanding broadband or even wireless broadband via 5G to all Americans is a bullet point on the Biden-Harris plan for rural America. But it's one of 10 bullet points on one plan at a time when dozens of priorities need a lot of attention and money. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative that focuses on America's farm and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, Matt Olean will review another new movie, and Sue Malcolm will join us for Main Street Eats. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A state lawmaker from Dickinson is denying claims from several female employees of the Legislative Council of sexual harassment and other inappropriate behavior. Some female legislators have also complained about Republican Representative Luke Simons. One council employee reported that he had massaged her shoulders and made comments about women's underwear. Simons, a barber and rancher, says the accusations are false.
I'm very friendly. I'm very outgoing. I've been accused of being flirtatious all of my life. The truth is, ladies, I could puke thinking about being with anybody besides my wife. I think it's literally disgusting. I've trained my brain to think that way. I treat women, I would hope, with respect. I was raised that way. I don't touch women that aren't my wife, including my own sister-in-laws, but I treat them as co-equals.
A number of women have asked that they no longer be required to work with Simons. In one claim made earlier this week, a Fargo lawmaker said Simons used the F word and said, "You're not my mother," when she asked him to put on his face covering while at the Capitol. The dean of the UND Medical School says despite falling COVID-19 case counts, it's not time to relax campus restrictions yet. Dr. Joshua Wynn told members of the State Board of Higher Education today that he still believes all faculty and staff will have the opportunity to be vaccinated before the start of the fall semester. Wynn says one area of concern remains: how well the current vaccine protects against the various new variants of the virus and whether they prevent transmission.
I continue to feel pretty confident that we will be able to get back to a new normal for the fall semester. I just don't think that we should rush things until we have some answers.
Wynn says he does believe the recent downturn in cases across the state is due to good practice of guidelines, the rollout of vaccines, and natural immunity. He still believes after a summer of transition, the 11 college campuses across the state will be able to transition to a new normal for the fall. And a Minnesota House committee has advanced a bill requiring public schools to implement a comprehensive sex education plan. Under it, school districts and charter schools would need to provide a comprehensive sex education program in elementary and secondary grades. The state education department would develop a model program. Minnesota DFL Representative Sydney Jordan said her bill would ensure students have the information they need to make smart decisions.
Every person makes important decisions about their sexual and reproductive health throughout their lifetime. However, Minnesota has no statewide standard for whether essential information about reproductive health, consent, or healthy relationships is provided in our schools.
A companion bill in the Senate has not been scheduled for a hearing. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt O'Lean, and this week, Matt, you went to another movie that was ripped from the history of our country. It was a turbulent time. I mean, it reminds me of the trial of the Chicago 7, the story that you went to see this week.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of movies this year, Doug. You know, headline movies kind of from that era. And this one is a story that I was not as familiar with, and I'm guessing a lot of audience members listening are not as familiar with, and that is the story of Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton was the leader of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panthers in the late 60s, and he was a rising star, just like Bobby Seale and some of the other members, you know, Eldridge Cleaver and whatnot. And he was only 21 years old when he became the chairman of the Illinois Black Panther group. But how he kind of used that power to try to instill good things in Chicago, like daycare and lunches and breakfast and things like that, that was his real goal. His other real goal was to try to kind of start a rainbow coalition, which is touched on in this movie, Judas and the Black Messiah, of organizing other groups to come in with the Black Panthers, like some of the street gangs and even a KKK group of poor white people. It was quite amazing what Hampton accomplished in his short time. What the movie is about, though, Doug, directed by Shaka King, his first feature film as a director, the film is about how the FBI infiltrated the Panthers in Illinois. And what they did was they used a career criminal by the name of William O'Neill, played by Lakeith Stanfield, in an excellent performance, to kind of offer him a deal to say, okay, we want you to get inside the Panthers and give us information on what's going on, and then we won't send you to jail for all your petty crimes. So Stanfield plays William O'Neill, who ingratiates himself with Fred Hampton, who Fred Hampton is played by Daniel Kaluuya from Get Out fame. The real key to this film is the two performances, Doug. These are outstanding, I think, are both going to be Oscar-nominated performances. What I'm hearing is Stanfield will be put in the lead actor category and Kahlua in the supporting. Now, Kahlua has the more showy role. Hampton gives speeches, fiery speeches, you know, I am a revolutionary, things like that. Stanfield has, I think, maybe the more tricky role, and that is the, you know, the snitch, the traitor, the Judas. You see the pain on his face as he works to try to infiltrate himself with Hampton, but he's also got to give the FBI information. The shocking thing about this movie when you walk out, Doug, is that this actually happened in this country, that the FBI essentially, you know, broke laws under Hoover to try to ruin the lives of members of the Black Panther community in Illinois. And it goes through all of the ways this was done. But just the arrogance of power. And of course, you know, Doug, at the time, the Chicago police force was not well regarded by African-American yeah. communities. So that's what the movie is about. And it's interesting. It's intricate. I like this one a lot. I think Shaka King's directorial control of this film is better than, say, Spike Lee's In Five Bloods, which came out earlier this year, and I wasn't as wild about that movie. And it's interesting how the Oscar talk for that film has faded and the Oscar talk for Judas and the Black Messiah has increased. And I think Stanfield, it would be a better choice as a Best Actor nominee over Delroy Lindo in Five Bloods if I'm to compare the two performances. But I like this film a lot. The only criticism I would have is sometimes there are too many characters popping up. In a film like this, which is very intricate, how the FBI informant works, things like that, he reports back to his FBI, the guy who's hired him, which is played by Jesse Plemons in the movie. Martin Sheen plays J. Edgar Hoover, by the way, in a very sinister performance, as you can imagine, Doug. But the only criticisms I would have is sometimes I think films are better off doing composite characters where they can reduce the number of characters that pop up, because there are several scenes. All of a sudden, a new character pops up, and I'm like, who is this? Is this an FBI agent? Is this a member of the Panthers? Who is this? And you don't get a lot of context. So I had the feeling the film could have been pared down just a little bit in terms of the characters, even though the focus is mostly on Fred Hampton and William O'Neill.
Well, I just remember those times. I was an impressionable teenager when all this was going on. As a matter of fact, I was actually a junior in college around this time, and J. Edgar Hoover was not beloved then, and I don't think he's worn well with time, but this was such an interesting snapshot in our history, and I think sometimes we forget it, and movies like this bring us back to how relevant and important it was.
Yeah, and I'm not going to, you know, talk too much about what happened in Fred Hampton's life. I want people to go see this movie. It is in theaters now. It's also available streaming, so you can make your choice of how you want to see this. But his story has not been well told over the years as compared to Bobby Seale and some of the other more famous, Bunchy Carter, some of the more famous members of the Black Panther group. But there was a real fear in the country, Doug, at this time, and it's portrayed in Sheen's performance as Hoover that, you know, basically quoting the blacks are going to take over the country. And this was, you know, Hoover instills this in the agents that they need to stop this at all costs. And the law breaking and the lines that they cross to do this is really quite frightening. The power of the FBI was almost unchecked at the time, Doug. And it's very frightening to watch this film to realize that these things actually happened.
Well, that's my Oscar trivia question. Actually, okay. This isn't about a movie or a performer who won, but it was nominated. And this is a story about a black leader who was assassinated, and it hit the screens in 1992. What was it?
That would be Malcolm X with Denzel Washington in his Oscar-nominated performance.
And Malcolm X was assassinated after a public split with the Nation of Islam. That was very famous, but there was always speculation around the time that there might have been law enforcement involvement in that. And mm-hmm. then it reminds me, if you just Google these days, you can find out that Medgar Evers was murdered in Jackson, Mississippi in 1963, the Birmingham, Alabama church bombing, four girls were killed in September of that year, three civil rights workers were killed near Philadelphia, Mississippi in June 1964, Malcolm X in February 65, three college students killed by police during a demonstration on the South Carolina State College campus in February of 68, and then Martin Luther King in Memphis of April of 1968, about the time this story is happening. We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lee.
I'm Tanzina Vega. Join me, Brian Lehrer, and Jamie Floyd for WNYC's annual MLK special with the Apollo Theater. Our esteemed guests include Congressman James Clyburn, Reverend Dr. William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, and New York Attorney General Letitia James. Join us.
MLK and the Fierce Urgency of Now. This week's Prairie Public Presents coming your way Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and because it's Thursday, it's time for Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
Sue joins us once a week from the Root Cellars Farm, her farm outside of Mandan. Sue, thanks as always.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here because there's nothing I like talking about more than gardening and food.
And this time you want to talk about jerky, and usually people think jerky, they think beef, sometimes turkey jerky, but you're talking veggie jerky here.
I know, it's something that I just kind of found by accident. Have you ever done it before?
I have had mushroom jerky, but I've never made it.
Oh, I love portobello mushrooms. Now, that would be something I'd like to start growing too, except I think I'm running out of room.
So I guess I'll start with this. Can any vegetable be jerkied? Is that a verb? I don't know.
I think it's jerked. I think when you jerk meat, okay. Right? So you jerk vegetables, and they might not like being jerked around, but that's too bad. There are some vegetables that work better than others because imagine that if it's had high moisture content like zucchini, it would just take a really long time to dry, which is basically what you're doing here. But you're seasoning it like you would meat jerky. And when I was pregnant, jerky was the one thing I couldn't eat. And I still have a hard time today, and that was like many years ago. But the thought of making vegetable jerky really excites me for a couple of reasons. One, I have a mandolin. Do you have a mandolin in your kitchen?
I had a French mandolin, and I don't know, I cut my finger, and now I don't have a French mandolin. You know, but I do have a KitchenAid slicer and spiralizer now, and that actually, that way I don't have to use my hands.
I bought those special gloves, and they work
the,
like
the
a charm.
The metal gloves?
You know, the don't slice your finger off.
What?
Yes. And why didn't somebody tell me about that before I took the tip of my finger off? My ring finger is still numb from my little sauerkraut accident last fall. And it made me think about this. You know, you watch all these movies all the time and you see these women, they get shot and then they get up and run in heels after the bad guy. Not ever going to happen. I cried like a baby when I cut the tip of my finger off. There's no way.
There probably as many nerves in your fingertip as anywhere in your body. But those special gloves are also good for the box grater.
Oh,
so they have
good
more than
idea.
One
I'm going to dig mine out.
I'm
going
to have to Google
drawer.
This. I don't have any idea what you guys are talking about.
Yeah, just search for mandolin glove. You'll find them. They're dirt cheap, and they work.
They use them in fast food restaurants that slice their own meats. That's how I found out about them. I had somebody that said, why don't you have a pair of those metal gloves? And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? I was thinking chainmail, you know, like days of yore, and thinking, how could you hold anything with a chainmail glove on? But Doug's right. They really do work. And they are less than 10 bucks a pair, and they're worth it, man. So I have a mandolin, and yes, every time I use it, I think to myself, take your time. Don't try to slice down to the very end of the whatever you're slicing. But I love using it because it's so perfect for like cucumber salad or slicing apples, you know, things that you want to have consistent. And when you're dehydrating food and or making vegetable jerky, it helps to have everything the same quarter inch thickness. That way things don't dry unevenly. So it's basically a method of, well, it works as preservation too for things like eggplant and carrots and cauliflower. Even tofu can be made into jerky. And I know all of you guys out there are thrilled to learn that. mushroom, zucchini.
Do you prepare the jerky in like a dehydrator or do you put it in the oven? How do you get to the next stage?
There's I do have a dehydrator. I've had it since about the 70s. And so it's really, was inexpensive, but it's a heavy duty one that you can add trays to. I love that thing. And they're very handy to have. But if you do not have one and you do not have room for another appliance in your kitchen, by all means, if you have a convected oven, that works exactly the same as a dehydrator. Now, the thing you have to watch, of course, is that the temperature is not too high. And I know that you can't go down lower than like 170 degrees on my particular range or my oven. For some reason, they mustn't think that you would ever need it to be any lower than that. But that's a good temp for drying things, 170 to 270, depending upon, you know, what you're drying. If you dry this stuff too fast, it gets crispy instead of chewy like it's supposed to. But the difference between this and dehydrating vegetables for storage is that you season them like you do regular jerky. Like let's say you have eggplant, which is everybody's favorite thing to grow, but nobody likes to eat it.
I like it pickled.
Well, there's the zucchini, too.
And the zucchini, right? Oh, my gosh, you guys. I had to sign a document that said I would not plant 5 zucchini plants this year in my garden. Like, but honey, they grow so fast. Oh, shoot. So what you do then, let's say you have an eggplant, or we still have carrots and we're eating them like crazy because they are delicious. They've been stored in my fridge and they're unwashed. And so we'll take a 2-gallon bag out, throw them in the sink, clean them all up. And they're just delicious and sweet. And then I thought I can save them from going bad by making a carrot jerky out of them. Okay. So for example, like eggplant, you think of Oriental food, I think a little bit more. So if you use like red pepper flakes and teriyaki sauce and a little bit of water, you slice the eggplant. And then you marinate it for, you know, a couple hours, flip them over. An eggplant is kind of like a sponge, so it really soaks things up. And then, you dry in the food dehydrator. And the recipe I have says at about 115. So I hope that your ovens go that low if you don't have a dehydrator, which, like I said, mine is a problem there.
Is there any advantage to taking making it more like the fruit roll-up approach? Like, so I make apple fruit roll-ups where I would be cooking the apples till they're soft and then pureeing in a blender and then pouring it in one of those dehydrator trays that obviously doesn't have holes in it. Would there be any advantage to pureeing the vegetables and making it more like vegetable roll-up jerky?
It would be more like a vegetable roll-up and less like a jerky then, right? Because you wouldn't be able – well, yeah, you could season it, I guess. That's a good idea, though.
I just think with that consistency
I might have to try
issue.
That. I wonder what a zucchini roll-up would taste
that's a
like.
Good point.
Well, and you know, some people have issues with the way things are texturally when they eat, you know, and I think – sometimes that's a problem with children. Like they might not mind the taste of something, but they'll mind the way it chews in their mouth. That's why I like to eat so much. I just like the way everything chews in my mouth.
I don't have very many issues.
I've never met something crunchy I didn't like, let me tell you that. That's something that would be very interesting to try. But have you ever roasted carrots with maple syrup? Because you can make carrot jerky with soy sauce and maple syrup. And of course, they always say to put that little bit of heat in there because it makes sweeter things sweeter, right? The little bit of sriracha or whatever. And I have, oh my gosh, you guys, I have a bazillion. Let's see, they're not ghost peppers. They're called red flame chilies that I dried from last year's garden, and I've been looking for something to do with them. So I might have to crush them up and make some wicked, healthy cookbook vegan jerky, which there was my shameless plug. These recipes come from the Wicked Healthy Cookbook, which was written by guys. So what woman in their right mind would think of making jerky out of vegetables? I don't know. So it had to have been a guy thing, right?
Yeah, it was probably something he couldn't get at the truck stop, huh? I was looking for some cauliflower jerky, for heaven's sakes, and all you got here is beef.
Oh, my gosh. So expect that this is going to take some time, like maybe 4 to 6 hours, to do your jerky and go in there and sample it. You know, we talked to her earlier this year about salt, heat, acid, and fire. Or heat, salt, acid, and fire. I don't know. Whatever order she had those little segments in. Oh, yeah, fat. That's right. Fire, fat, smoke, fat, whatever they are. She talked about the different things that give food flavor. So one of the things that I do now that I never did before was she said you just have to taste when you're cooking. Taste when you're cooking and season as you go along. There are good times to season. There are bad times to season. And so that's one of the things that you should do with your jerky is go in and try it. Like if you like it chewy, it won't take as long. If you want it to be crisp like a veggie chip, hey, I think these guys maybe copped the veggie chip idea, called it jerky so guys would eat it. That's
everything
what
is
they
just
did.
A new branding.
Right. So then that way you can have it to whatever, you know, degree of chewy you want. And of course, you can keep them in a jar on your cupboard and just snack on them all day long. If you want them to keep longer, you might want to put them in your freezer. If there's any moisture left and you close these things up in a bag, you're going to get mold because any little bit of moisture without being refrigerated or frozen or properly preserved will eventually become moldy. Now, sometimes I've been known to cut the mold off of things and eat them anyway, but don't do that. And don't, I never said that.
I don't know if you know how recordings work, Sue.
That's my cheese approach.
What the heck? I ain't dead yet, you know? So cheese is mold, you know? And it's so funny because I know there's people that complain about yogurt. They don't like Greek yogurt. It's basically sour cream. You know, like it's the same process. You make milk sour just by varying degrees, and you have sour cream versus yogurt versus clabbered milk or whatever else you want there. So, and I would like to try tofu, which of course we all know is soybean curd, kind of. And I've always been a big fan of tofu in my Chinese food. When I go to restaurants, I'll have them substitute the meat for tofu because I love the way it chews when it's fried.
Yeah.
So, but mushrooms, yeah, I can imagine that mushroom jerky would be divine. Spongy, will soak up lots of flavor.
I'm going to have to try this out. I've got the mandolin, I've got the glove, I've got the oven, I've got the spices. It's time to get the eggplant going.
Right on. Now, I don't know if that's in season yet, but there's got to be something out there at the supermarket we can all experiment with. So go for it.
Okay. We check in with Sue Belcom every Thursday. It's always a pleasure, Sue.
Oh, thank you. The pleasure is mine.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
On the next Prairie Mosaic, we'll harvest Minnesota wild rice, learn about the art of alcohol ink, meet a multimedia artist, and listen to original folk music from Dan Israel, all on the next Prairie Mosaic.
Watch an all-new Prairie Mosaic tonight at 8:30 Central, 7:30 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 25th. On this date in 1969, the North Dakota Senate Agriculture Committee heard a contentious argument over the destiny of milk prices. On one side was the Milk Stabilization Board, which wanted more power to set the minimum price of milk in the state. On the other side was the North Dakota Food Retailers Association, which believed those powers were unfair and possibly unconstitutional. Fixing the price of milk has a long history. In 1883, dairy farmers in New York refused to sell their milk when they deemed the price too low. In 1918, the city of Minot passed an ordinance that set the price of milk so dairy farmers wouldn't refuse to sell their milk. The state of North Dakota was keen on helping the state's dairy industry when dairies outside of North Dakota started selling excess milk in the state. Thus, the Milk Stabilization Board was formed in 1967. The board consists of five members appointed by the governor: a dairy farmer, a milk processor, a retailer who sold milk, and two consumers who were not engaged in the milk industry. In 1969, the Milk Stabilization Board got what it wanted: the ability to set minimum prices, regulate the grade A dairy industry, and a 5 cents per hundredweight assessment paid by milk processors. The assessment helped pay for the board's work. The board was also able to work on preventing dairies from other states dumping milk in North Dakota. In 1995, the board's name was changed to the Milk Marketing Board. The board's work has not been without controversy. Some decisions made by the board have dismayed retailers, such as the rule that private haulers could deliver milk to stores as long as 45 cases were ordered. This put small rural stores in a bind. However, some scholars applaud the board's work in helping build strong and stable communities by supporting the dairy industry. As of 2021, only six other states have milk pricing programs: Maine, Montana, Nevada, New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I'm Dave Thompson. This week's Legislative Review guest will be Republican Senator Brad Beckedahl of Williston. We'll talk about what's been accomplished thus far, what the main issues and sticking points will be after crossover, and about bills specifically for northwestern North Dakota and the oil patch. Legislative Review airs at 6:30 p.m. Central Time on our radio service and anytime on our digital platforms.
Paying tuition can put pressure on many college students, especially during a pandemic. One student's stress landed her in the hospital, and then she had a new problem.
And I see it's a bill for $3,500.
Now she's fighting not to pay.
I don't think you get anything unless you, like, yell for it in this country. I've been here for 5 months and I've realized that already.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. On our show Friday, we'll hold our monthly Journalist Roundtable. It'll include, of course, News Director Dave Thompson and special guests Amy Dalrymple-Moulter with the Bismarck Tribune and Jacob Noderman with KFYR. The legislature is at crossover. We'll talk about the bills that are still alive and the issues behind them. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday and our Journalist Roundtable. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.